Welcome to the Reaction Podcast with me, Alistair Benn. I'm joined this week by Nimco Ali, an anti-FGM campaigner and writer and co-founder of the charity Daughters of Eve. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
I just wanted to first ask you, how did you get into activism? What brought you into campaigning on this specific issue?
So I came into campaigning because I had a personal experience of FGM. I was cut when I was 7 years old, but ultimately I never really spoke about it until I was about 28, 27. And what really changed my narrative was meeting young girls who had been subjected to FGM themselves, living here in the UK, and just seeing that the constant narrative about us talking at girls and never necessarily engaging with them. So I knew, having worked in government, that I could really do something. So I gave up my job in 2010 and became an activist.
So why do you think you were silent about it for 20 years?
I think nobody understood. I wasn't silent about it when I first had FGM. I was very open, and I was very open until I was about 11. So when I came back as a seven-year-old, I was very confused because for me, it happened really out of context. I had... it's weird to say, but I had a really progressive and feminist mother and grandmother, but I realised that they had no power in that time in order to do anything. I didn't have that knowledge when I was seven. So when nobody around me was talking about this really weird act, painful, but weird was the most thing, was the act that happened to me. I came back to school and I asked my teacher, who was the keeper of all knowledge, as I found, like, you know, as I thought to myself. And I was very explicit and I was very open about what had happened to me. And she said to me what was really interesting and really painful. She said, that's what happens to girls like you. It's a little bit like a bar mitzvah. And I had a context to what a bar mitzvah was, and I thought it was nothing like that because it wasn't as amazing and nobody really talked about it and there wasn't anybody invited to a party. So I kind of just stayed silent because I think she shocked me into silence, into the sense that she had nothing to tell me. And then when I was 11, because I had a really invasive form of FGM, I was medicalized because I almost died. And at that moment as well, I was very... aware that the medical staff knew what had happened to my anatomy and knew that there was something weird that had happened and something that they needed to correct. But yet again, they said nothing about it. So as a 11-year-old coming out of a hospital, I decided that the adults around me really had no understanding of what FGM was, or maybe I had a different understanding because I thought it was wrong and nobody else thought it was wrong. So I started to find George Orwell and Noel Adeslaoui, who's an Egyptian writer, and a lot of other people that were really writing about thinking differently. And for me, it was like from the age of 11 until I was about 27, I didn't really say anything really openly.
Mm.
So yeah.
So you said someone compared it to a bar mitzvah. It's nothing like circumcision.
It is nothing like circumcision in the sense that, I don't support male circumcision either on children. Obviously, there's medical needs for male circumcision, but I think the idea of choice and consent is really key to that. So children can't consent to medical procedures like male circumcision. But the thing about female genital mutilation is that it mutilates the anatomy from its natural position. It ultimately affects the functions of the female anatomy forever. It doesn't mean that women can't get some reconstructive surgery and some support along the way, but it can never be 100%. And ultimately, the role of it opens up other forms of gender-based violence. So if girls are cut, then they're most likely to not be educated, to be in domestic abuse relationships, to be in families where they're overtly chastised. So it ultimately changes the value of girls within a society, not just within a family. So I think that's the complete difference to male circumcision, where men are kind of given the keys to the kingdom as soon as they have their foreskin removed.
So there seems to be, I think, two things you're saying, that there's a kind of silence on a personal level because it's so traumatic.
Yeah.
And then a kind of silence in UK society where people don't understand what faith practices it comes from, or what ritual practices it comes from, or where it comes from. So there's a kind of inability to talk.
I think there's inability to engage. So yeah. The idea that somebody that's not affected by FGM would understand what it is without somebody that is affected by it talking about it is quite, like, you know, that's not going to happen. I can, like, you know, having never, if I was here as somebody that had never undergone FGM, I could sit here and, like, you know, project and like, you know, try to imagine it, but I don't necessarily know the, like, you know, the gravity of the issue unless I speak to somebody directly. And I think that's why personal testaments are very important, and why allowing women to express their emotions and their experience is fundamental to ending FGM. So yeah, but I think that's a very conscious and a very what's the word I'm looking for? It's not an accident. It's not an accident that there's a disengagement between those that can actually really end FGM and those that are affected by FGM, because of the fact that if you connect, then you understand the things that we understand now, that FGM is a form of violence against women and girls. It can end, but we really need to be empowering women, and if we empower women, then we can change the landscape of a lot of communities. So yeah, so my teacher, when I spoke to her, I don't necessarily think she was being bad or being horrible by trying to make me feel better by saying this is what happens to girls like you. I just think she wasn't equipped with the knowledge, and I hadn't as a 7-year-old yet learned that I should be embarrassed about the experience that I had. And I think that the reason why I've been quite successful in my activism is because I've never been embarrassed of the FGM that I had. I've been angry to a certain extent, and I've also been hurt, but I've just never been ashamed of talking about it.
So you talk about FGM specifically as a form of violence against women, but in general, particularly in the public debate in the UK and perhaps in America, FGM is often used as a way of browbeating one particular minority, and that's Islam. People use it, say, this culture is non-Western, it's backward, because FGM is an accepted form of ritual practice. But that's not true, is it?
So I think a lot of people in the West have said that FGM is Islamic. It has no religious basis in any of the four books. There are no edicts within it. So yeah, there are no religious edicts that say that FGM should be practiced, but it's because of the fact that the people who've always been asked about it have been men, and most of those men have been religious men, that we've kind of linked this conversation onwards. So places like Saudi Arabia don't have FGM, but they have other forms of gender-based violence. And in terms of FGM itself, it's evident in both religious countries and non-religious countries. And yeah, there is no religious basis to it, but I just think a lot of the people that have been outspoken, from Noelle Adeslawi to myself to Edna to Ayan Hirsi Ali, have all come from a very specific cultural and faith background, and people assume that it was because of our faith we had FGM.
Yeah.
But I learned that very quickly, that it had nothing to do with my faith, it had nothing to do with my culture, it was essentially about my gender.
And that's really interesting distinction. And this is kind of coming back to Islam. You mentioned Ayan Hirsi Ali wrote, you know, incredible book, The Cage Version, which has an extraordinary personal account of a liberation story, which is just, you know, something to reflect on and be very humble about. But the book is also a kind of tract in support of a particular interpretation of the Enlightenment.
Yeah.
Actually, it's full of phrases like, let us have a Voltaire. And she thinks, I think, the answer is, it's about religious demystification. So the way you stop FGM is by telling people to free themselves from sort of, quote-unquote, backwards, regressive religious practice. But is this a kind of double-edged manoeuvre?
It is. But the thing about Ayan Hirsi Ali, it's like, I've never met her, but I would love to have a conversation with her, is the fact that it's easier for us to place something on theology and the mystical as opposed to the personal.
Hmm.
So it's indirectly, I think her, I've read both The Cage Virgin, Nomad, and other ones that she's written. But what was the other? Infidel. So, but the thing about Ayan Hirsi Ali is, like, as a Somali woman, I know her issue is not with Islam. Her issue is with the patriarchy and the misogyny within the Somali community. And that is something I come up against on a day-to-day basis, but I challenge it. I've also got to the point where I realise that I know I am who I am because I've had amazing feminist men within my family. So my grandfather, my four brothers, both, like, you know, all very feminist northern Somali men, have always stood alongside me and have also taught me Islam to the perspective that it of its beauty. And the concept that enlightenment happened in the 17th century is something that we have to constantly address. It's like, they were, like, you know, it's not the enlightenment of the Western societies that have actually brought us civilization. Civilization existed pre, like, you know, for 5,000 years before that. So I think the thing about Ayan Hirsi Ali and a lot of people that sometimes start like, you know, attacking theology as opposed to the things that are around them and blame the oppression that they feel is a very problematic one. I think as someone that was raised Muslim and educated the Catholic, I see both the beauty and the problems with, like, you know, very dogmatic interpretations of any religion, but then at the same time there is real choice within that. And I have sisters that wear the burqa who have done it through choice. I have sisters that wear bikinis. I have all these, so, but through that there's always free and fair choice. And I think with somebody like Ayaan Hirsi Ali and those narratives, they're very, it's a very dangerous one, it's a very racist one, and it's a very she is actually quite evangelical to a certain extent herself, so you can't really be fighting the extremist Muslims with, like, you know, other extremist theologies like she is.
Yeah, absolutely. Is it kind of, I think people have a real empathy deficit, because it seems to me that wherever there's power, there is abuse.
Yeah.
Whether it's in a school or in a church background or wherever, or even in a family, where there's an imbalance of power, there's always the capacity for threat and abuse to happen.
Yeah.
And FGM is another example of those things. But it seems to be bound up with all these cultural blind spots in the UK, which make it difficult to talk about.
It is, because a lot of the families that practice FGM don't necessarily have other indicators of child abuse. And you know what abusers do? So the church, it's hidden, it's abuse very well with a lot of celebrations and beauty and, like, you know, shiny things. I've never seen anybody from the Vatican that's, like, you know, walking, like, you know, barefoot or living a very poverty stricken life. And that's, like, and that's interesting to me. Just the same as a lot of these families where FGM is predominant. A lot of them have a lot of, like, you know, beautiful cultural things that we all find interesting and can't really separate between the act of violence that's happening to children. But we have to do that, and I think we have to ultimately speak to women and have conversations with women about identity and the idea that you can be, for me, I can be Somali without FGM, I can be Muslim without wearing a headscarf, I can be British without necessarily being white. There are many things that we try to interlink, and they're not mutually exclusive to each other. So those are the conversations to have. And because I've sat around for almost 18 years of my life post FGM thinking and reading, I've been able to unpick those things, and I've able to understand that I'm 100% me, but I'm not 100% anything. I can never be 100% Somali because there are things that, like, you know, fall out of the narrative that which is Somali. I can never be British because I don't look British. So there's a lot of things, but I'm very comfortable in that no man's land. And it's really rare for a lot of people to be comfortable in that. So in this new age of first generation and second generation, specifically Somalis, because I can only talk to my own experience, is that a lot of us find it difficult to have these mirrored images of our identity. So we pick onto one. And the one that has been spoken very clearly right now is this new interpretation of Islam through a Wahhabi narrative, which is a strict and a very literal interpretation of Islam, but is also one that eases the soul of a lot of people who don't necessarily have anywhere else to fit into right now.
It's about purity.
It is.
Really. It's really interesting that you're talking about, you know, that there's a kind of liberation in being free about these categories.
Yeah.
At which, I suppose, FGM is a kind of unstable centre. Like, it kind of comes into all these things. And I know you've been quite critical, maybe, of people on the new left.
They're not necessarily that new, because I grew up behind them. I grew up behind a very traditional Labour Party in Cardiff.
Mm.
I grew up in the sense that, and I think this is the oxymoron, that the fact that the Labour Party thinks it represents me but doesn't necessarily understand me. Yeah.
There's a rigidity to categories.
I think it kind of, and this is so since 2010, the largest population of black people in the UK are either African-born or with African heritage. And the African black community is different to the West African community in the sense of lineage and experience and everything else. I think the first generation is different. I'm not necessarily saying that the second generation of young people, as we see things like knife crime and like, you know, the growing rates of prison systems and lack of attainment, are not suffering the same things that black boys in the African Caribbean community suffered. But at the same time, there's a lack of knowledge and understanding, and also I think a fear of the comfortability that I have in my own identity and the comfortability that I have in order to challenge and the comfortability and not to be tribal. I think a lot of us who are African and have grown up here or African first generation all ended up as political asylum seekers or political refugees. And what political refuge teaches you is about the danger of ever taking sides and ever becoming tribal. And the left itself are very tribal. It's very hard to ever move them anywhere on anything. So the idea of young black people being able to go to Oxbridge and actually attain is something that they spout that they want, but they never really do anything about it. They never take any steps to do that. But then when young black boys or young black girls get to Oxbridge or they get to top jobs, then they're like, oh, you're a sellout. Or that. And then it becomes a problematic thing for them. So the left have always... an ironic entitlement to people like me, but yet at the same time do very little for people like me, and that's very disconcerting. So I could easily turn into an Ayaan Hirsi Ali in the sense that I could just leave and just write about the experiences and not necessarily live it and be there on a day-to-day basis, but I'm immensely privileged, and I think it's only right that I come back and I remind people that there is another way. And I don't really care whoever you vote for. I want you to vote. That's a fundamental thing. But I want political parties to engage you. And I want political parties to actually understand that your vote is as equal as anybody else's in this country.
That's really interesting. So I suppose, and correct me if I'm wrong, is you're kind of saying that you can have a liberation politics that is based on race, but that doesn't treat whole populations as kind of blocks.
Yeah.
Like, so for example, if we look at the UK, we have Scotland, England, Wales and Northern Ireland. Any politics that treats maybe Scotland and Northern Ireland as just Celtic would be absurd. It would be silly. And yet, on the other side, a lot of sort of liberation politics is always rooted in a kind of sense that there's just a block.
Of black people, of brown people, of... so it is the assumption of this is what I think you want, this is what you need, and this is how I'm going to liberate you. So I think, and that's the thing, there is a lack of empowerment and engagement. So if you are trying to liberate me from a form of oppression, then please give me the power. Don't necessarily try to help me out. So there's a savior context within that, and then when you are side to side with the left or the so-called left or the people trying to liberate you, and you are actually doing better than they are, they're very confused by that. So I found that to my detriment very forcefully and very painfully in the last general election, in the sense that I stood for the Women's Equality Party. They are a non-partisan party, but just believes in the empowerment of women. So you can't treat women to a certain extent as homogenous, but then there's intersexual things about race, the disability, financial. So those are things come in. But as women, 100% of us are not getting paid equally. We are dying at a rate of 2 a week. Within the maternity system, it's not being funded. Breast cancer is killing us. There's all these things that are happening. So obviously I'm going to say that these things directly apply to women, so that's why I'm going to stand. But the left was just so shocked, honestly. Lib Dems, Conservatives, Greens were fine, there's diversity on a panel, but the idea that the Labour Party, the Labour Party as it stands under Corbyn, was just shocked. How dare I stand? And it was really, how dare I stand against a white woman who's going to liberate me? And I was like, I can actually liberate myself, and I can actually help to liberate other women. And nobody understands that. And I always compare it to a lecturer at SOAS can go to Africa for a year and teach African studies, but I could have a PhD in British like, you know, history, and I would never be able to give to get such a job. So yeah, it's a weird one, but it's one that I'm very familiar with. It's a bit like that tweet or whatever he, like, Jeremy Corbyn put out saying only the Labour Party could unleash the talent of black people. I just think, what are you actually talking about? It's like, what does that even mean? I think I've been more successful in my life because there hasn't been a Labour Party like his in power. Had there been, so I came of age under the Blair era, and that was the moment when the UK, it was like we had the Spice Girls, 1998 was cool. I was just like about, I was 15, I was about to do my GCSEs, I had aspirations, it was really, really cool. I don't think young black kids today, and I say black as both African, dual heritage, and African Caribbean kids, have the same opportunities that I do, or I would, and I don't think there's that same engagement or potential for them to succeed coming from the Labour Party. And that scares me, and that's sad, because the fact that I've got young cousins and they're going to do well, but they're going to do well because I did well. And I did well because I had parents that had aspirations for me.
So there's, you know, Blair era multiculturalism has kind of descended into something quite different.
Yeah.
And that was quite robust. It was state-led multiculturalism in the early 2000s, but it now is sort of morphed.
No, it was very cool. It was very targeted, and it was very honest. And it was the fact that I think it was when he was doing the brand Britain. This is who we are. We are British. We're different. We're the Spice Girls. We're Oasis. We're this. We're that. You felt British, and you could actually say, okay, cool. I feel British. I feel the fact that I belong. And in that sense, right now, in a post-Brexit era, that's what we need to kind of bring us together, saying the fact that we're all British and we're all in this together. But that doesn't exist because the Labour Party wants to blame all the ills of the world. Like, austerity is terrible. I will fight austerity on a day-to-day basis. Austerity is affecting women more than it's affecting just a homogenous people of colour, or, like, you know, the poor or disabled. Women are the ones at the forefront that are facing all this. But the Labour Party doesn't have a place for women. It doesn't have a place for black people. It doesn't have a place for people that have some kind of, that are non-white, that also want to talk about something that's different. I'm not saying that the Conservative Party has that either, but the Conservative Party, from what I found, are more conducive to a conversation, and they will disagree with you. And, like, you know, I will disagree with you, but then I will lobby you in order to change that. The Labour Party, there's no way to start, because they think they have it already covered by I always say that we need a third runway. We don't need a third runway, we need a third party, and that's hopefully what might come out in the next few years.
And kind of interesting on the Tory party. So I've always felt that in the same way, speaking more generally, in the same way as the Labour Party, I think, has a massive blind spot, especially the Labour Party at the moment, has a big blind spot on the traumas inflicted by state-led socialism in the Eastern Bloc and things like that. The Tory Party also has had a problem with colonialism.
Yeah.
And take, like, Cecil Rhodes, for example. I remember in that controversy, there were people at the Telegraph writing sort of op-eds being like, you know, Cecil Rhodes was actually a kind of a good guy who was doing a
difficult job. He only killed a few slaves.
Exactly. Yeah. But in the same way as we say, for example, like, I'd certainly say that, for example, someone like Fidel Castro was a thug.
Yeah.
I'd also say that Cecil Rhodes was obviously a thug and an acquisitive thug and a greedy thug and not someone who had any idealism or anything like that. But you're saying that the Tory party sort of is handling it, maybe.
But the thing about Cecil is the fact that he's dead, and his policies are not actually being used in order to run us on a day-to-day basis. It's the fact that I don't really care about statues. It's like, I've got other things to worry about. It's a bit, so I'm from Bristol, and the idea of Colston Hall having to be renamed because he was named by a slave, it was named after a slave owner. Okay. Like, I get that, but it's like, I think people are so focused on things that are not necessarily representative or impactful on the lives of people today that it means that we're not doing anything about something else. It's the whole point. It's like, I'm not going to sit here and say that we need to take down a statue. If we were going to put up a new statue and celebrate this person, I'd have an issue with that. But if this statue pre-existed and it was put up because he'd put some endowment into a building or whatever it was, I don't really care. It's just like one of those things, like, I don't care who builds a hospital as long as it's built and as long as people are treated. But if your policies and your views and your theology is actually impacting people, and you want to make that today's, like, you know, so something that's going to be a relative, it's going to be relative to people today, then I have an issue with that. Nobody wants to move to Cuba, but they want to take Cuban policies and bring it here. So that is the difference in that kind of sense. And I think the notion of the Tory party being, they're romantic to a lot of offensive things, but there's a difference between being romantic about offensive things than actually being so romantic that you want to implement and use those as, like, you know, policies of today's economic, like, you know, policies. That is actually quite scary. That is why John McDonnell scares the hell out of me. The idea that John McDonnell is either a chancellor, he's going to put so many people out of business that he's not even going to be able to afford to pay for their, like, their welfare. I believe in the welfare state. I will support the welfare state. I will fight the Conservative government in terms of the stuff that they're cutting and the things that they're doing. And I will hold my friends who are within the party accountable to that. But at the same time, I'm not going to do that by voting for a man that's actually going to make us poorer and unhealthier. So yeah, it's I think the left are more dangerous. And I can, like I said, I've met more racists that are on the left than I have on the right. The right are just a little bit old and offensive. And I do have conversations with a lot of people that talk about Africa as a country on the right. You know, I hate saying on the right, on the right with a political agenda. But I can correct that. I can't correct a guy that it's on the left that thinks he knows, not only knows everything about Africa, but also knows what it's like to live under a dictator. I've lived under a dictator. I've lived under those policies. I've seen how they starve and they hurt the most vulnerable in society. I've seen how they silence the most powerful. I've seen how it's either their way or no way. And I'm a Democrat and I want a democracy. And I don't necessarily think that Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell are beneficial to the world that I want to see for myself and my nieces and nephews.
Yeah, so performative wokeness is obviously no compensation for real action.
No,
it's
not.
Like an obsession with categories, which is what we're talking about.
Yeah, so I wouldn't, like, I don't believe in nationalising anything, but at the same time, I believe in better schools, I believe in better, I believe in a lot of these, like, you know, idealist things that Jeremy Corbyn talks about, but I also want to pay for them. I don't want to stay on a day-to-day basis, oh, I want to, like, you know, I want everybody to have a three-day weekend, but what are you going to do, add another day to the week? It's like, it just doesn't make it, like, none of it actually makes sense. If he's going to make an eight-day week and change our calendar, change our system, give me the policy and I can at least look at that. But when you, like, I don't like people not paying their taxes, but at the same time, I'm going to negotiate with them, I'm going to have a conversation and I'm going to make the case. I'm not going to threaten the biggest employers in this country so they can leave and go somewhere else, because they will leave and go somewhere else. And I think that is what he doesn't understand, is that, and a lot of my friends who think they live in South Chelsea, which is also actually known as Battersea, are shooting themselves in the foot. We're like, you know, I'm getting rid of an amazing MP like Jane Ellison because she's a Tory. She's a credible woman that worked for 30 years in business and is now your MP, and she understands each and every single one of you. The person that's there right now, like the Mayor of London, aesthetically looks fine, but is actually not qualified to run a country and not qualified to be an MP. And I think that is a tokenism that's with the left as well, is that they will put people in positions of power because they look well, not because they can actually do anything. Not that I'm not saying that there's no nepotism on the right, and that is the main thing about the nepotism on the right, but I think tokenism is a massive issue as well, and you can't, like, that's not the way to run a country.
And how does that affect your arguments for, you know, with Daughters of Eve about FGM? Does it make it harder to get real change on the left if there's this
I'm happy to say that the left doesn't really care, like, it's like or certain people, so no, actually not the left, okay, let me qualify that. I think Jeremy Corbyn and his ilk don't care about young brown girls, and they didn't care about me when I was 7, they didn't care about me when I was 11, and the only reason why any of them might talk to me now or talk to people that look like me is to assume my vote. But when I say that actually I can vote for somebody else, then they know that the fact that I have the power to do that. And if I could do one thing, is about actually saying to the Somali community specifically, 11 young boys have died in the first 3 months of this year. The first 8 weeks of this year. like 11 young Somali boys died on the streets of London, and they are the largest voting black Muslim bloc in the UK, and specifically in London. Like, the mayor actually doesn't care. And that is really, really the sad thing. He actually does not care about young boys that are dying on the streets of London. He doesn't care about people that are losing their jobs. He doesn't care about housing. He doesn't care about any of these things. But you guys are all still going to vote for him. So I'm not really sure who the joke is on, really. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think Jeremy Corbyn definitely doesn't care about me.
So we've ranged quite widely over all sorts of stuff on politics. So where next for Daughters of Eve specifically? Do you have any projects coming up or campaigns?
In terms of the work to end FGM, we're looking at a global levels, global kind of work. So ending FGM by 2030 is the global goal, and that is really a tangible reality. So for me right now is actually engaging back with the UK government. So the UK is the leading committer to ending FGM. They committed $35 million in 2013, and that is about to be recommitted again, hopefully, as more as much money would be as needed will be committed. So it's about making that case, and I think if we don't scale up the work and we don't work with women on the ground in Africa directly, the global statistics are that we could add 70 million girls to the 200 million women girls who've already been cut by 2030. But I think change is possible, it's not inevitable, and I really want to play my role in making that happen. In saying that, and also having said what I said about Jeremy Corbyn and the new left, I'm open to working with them. I'm open to, like, you know, I would rather a collaborative working where both political parties, the Queen's opposition and the Queen's government, led on the work to end FGM by 2030. I was let down 28 years ago, but I have a beautiful niece who will never be cut. She's 7 years old, but the same age as I was when I was cut. And she's a Londoner and she's British and she's, like, you know, as perfect as she could be. So if the polls are correct and Jeremy Corbyn is going to be our next leader, I'm happy to work with him because I'm not that petty to say that I won't work with somebody in order to protect girls. So, for me is to get both the Foreign Office and also DFID to keep recommitting and get the Prime Minister to ensure that we lead the fight to end FGM by 2030.
Fantastic stuff. Thanks so much for coming on, Nim Kohali.
Thank you for having me.